confronting the interrelated environmental crises in the U.S. From hurricanes to wildfires, tainted drinking water to ocean dead zones, droughts to disappearing coastline, during the past few years, the U.S. has faced severe and numerous environmental crises. The author of a new book shows how many of these problems are interrelated and exacerbated by climate change. The book is Breakpoint, Reckoning with America's Environmental Crises by Jeremy Jackson and Steve Chappell. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll speak with one of the authors, Jeremy Jackson, who lives part-time in Maine. He is joined by Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. What are your questions about how climate change is affecting our nation and your community, and what can be done? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Tune into the news, and we hear about droughts, floods, fires, hurricanes, and other environmental crises. How are these connected, and what can be done to prepare our country for environmental threats to come? Joining me in the studio, Jeremy Jackson, who's an emeritus professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He lives part-time in Brooksville, Maine. His new book, Breakpoint, deals with this topic. And Peter Neal is here, too. He's director of the World Ocean Observatory. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about changes in the environment? Do you think about solutions? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Jeremy, to write this book, you took a road trip starting in the Midwest and going down the Mississippi to the Mississippi Delta. Why did you choose a road trip, and why this route?
Well, first of all, I guess my interest in writing the book was the realization that climate change wasn't something in the future. It was happening right now. And that we were really at what the title of the book is, a breakpoint. And I wanted to get out of my ivory tower. I was still teaching at the time. And just go and see the places that I, as an intellectual, felt, you know, as a scientist felt, were being hampered by climate change, by stupid farming practices, by unwise settlement along the coasts and all the rest. And what could be more romantic and fun than to start out at the headwaters of the Mississippi and just work your way down? And it was really an eye-opener. It was absolutely fascinating because even the people who are doing things that you think are wrong and that should be stopped or whatever, when you meet them and you realize they're people and that they're interesting people and that they share their points of view and information, it was a real listening and learning experience. And by the time we were done on the Mississippi Delta, we realized that what we'd seen was a metaphor for the entire country.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because one of the things that struck me about your book, about the people that you met on your road trip, is that you don't frame anyone as the enemy. That you talk with a farmer who farms GMO corn, and he believes ethanol is good for the planet. And you talk with people with divergent views on what to do in the Mississippi Delta. But you find, as you said, it's clear from the way you write about them that you find all of these people smart and engaging and people who care about their communities.
And fun and nice and generous.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if that's part of the philosophy of yours, that this isn't about bad guys and good guys.
No, it's about a crisis that humanity is in, not facing in the future, but in today. And it's all around us, you know. Heat waves that killed 35,000 people in Europe in 2003, the fate of Phoenix and the entire Southwest. These are things that are happening now. Sea level rise is happening now, and people haven't really digested it. They haven't really come to grips with the fact that we are on the verge of a precipice of change, and we got to be ready for it. The good news and the bad news is that there are people who are figuring it out, and opinions are changing.
And I want to ask you, Peter, if you share this philosophy.
Yeah, I do. I think that there are solutions, but I think to point to the title of the book is really important. It's not the tipping point. The tipping point implies that there's some imbalance that can be redressed. We can get back in balance. A breaking point is different. A breaking point means that the system is broken and it's not easy to repair. And in these instances, some of the damage that has been done that is manifesting itself in change are irreparable. And therefore, in order to have solutions, we have to think about things very differently. Mm. And Jeremy's book brings that into very, very sharp focus.
And mitigation is as big a part of the conversation as prevention now.
Well, let me speak to that briefly. The great words are adaptation and mitigation. Adaptation means sort of adapting to the situation, which I think is just simply opting for the status quo. You adapt, therefore you sort of normalize the crisis. Mitigation is a sort of a short-term response. Engineering, for example, levees, seawalls, that kind of thing. So we mitigate those things, but those are not long-term solutions. I argue for invention. The only way we're going to deal with this is that we're going to have to invent our way out of it, and that poses some very critical conversations and questions for people in terms of what are the solutions, in terms of what's next.
Two of the biggest points you make in the book, Jeremy, tell me if I'm being a good student here, are one, that everything is interconnected, that one environmental problem fuels another, and two, that what we have been talking about over the past few years or few decades as unusual events aren't unusual at all. The floods, the droughts, the hurricanes, these are perfectly expected.
The 100-year storm happens every 3 years. I mean, the new normal is something that we still want to believe is in the future if we don't behave better. But in fact, it's already now. And my God, last summer, you know, we had to rewrite parts of the book. It was about to go to press. But last summer, not only did we have the extraordinary firestorms in the West, but we had three hurricanes within 5 or 6 weeks of each other, each one of which was a Category 5. The previous record for the number of storms that strong to hit the United States in a year was one, and we had three, and they wreaked extraordinary damage. And it had been predicted. The Hurricane Center had said it was going to be a bad year. This coming up year, we're all worried, is going to be another bad year. These are things that aren't going away. They're happening, happening, happening.
Peter, whenever I see reports, though, I see this very careful caveat. Experts will be on the news and they will say, of course, we can't draw a direct link between this terrible hurricane and climate change. What do you say to that? To all those voices of caution out there?
Well, are they voices of caution or are they voices of opposition sort of cautionarily expressed? The science continues to affirm and affirm and affirm again very specific connections.
And we predict, and one of the most important things we predicted in terms of hurricanes and global warming, hurricane is a heat engine. Scientists said very clearly that hurricanes will be stronger when they're born over hotter water. Harvey was a piddling tropical depression last summer. It encountered a body of very hot water. It went from a tropical depression to a Category 4 hurricane in something like 48 hours. Exactly what the scientists had said. The mechanisms, we predict them, we see the result, and yet you get that sort of, oh. I think actually there has been a tipping point in public acceptance and awareness that these things are related to climate change and that they are problems. Now, what we do about that or don't do about it and all the political intransigence, that's a different story. But there has been a major change that the majority of people in this country believe that climate change is real, that it's caused by people from fossil fuels, and that it's a bad thing. How they go beyond that, they don't know.
Let's talk about the interconnectedness. Talk about how the drinking water problems in the upper Midwest are related to the dead zone in the ocean in the Gulf of Mexico.
So industrial farming, the miracle farming that makes the ethanol, which, by the way, we don't need, uses enormous amounts of fertilizer, and it plows in the way that makes fields very vulnerable to erosion. Exactly the wrong sort of thing to do in a world which is getting more and more of its rainfall concentrated in these torrential storms. And so what's happening in Iowa, which is sort of the laboratory of industrial agriculture, is that we're getting these big storms and vast amounts of soil and nutrients, the fertilizer, are going into the Great Lakes and also going downstream to the Gulf of Mexico. Just the way you put fertilizer on your lawn to make the lawn grow better, fertilizer in the water of the Great Lakes feeds algae. And so you get these gigantic algal blooms. What's terrible in Lake Erie is that the algae that bloom are called cyanobacteria. They make a toxin which is absolutely deadly. The water supply of Toledo was shut down for 2 days in a little episode of one of those blooms forming. And so you have the drinking water for something like 30 million people being poisoned by these algae that are the consequence of the runoff of too much fertilizer from fields in the Midwest. The dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is the same thing. It's a big, gigantic algal bloom. And when those cells rot and fall to the bottom, they suck all the oxygen out of the water. And so there's no oxygen, and fish and crabs either swim away or they die.
So speaking to interconnectedness, and this is what Jeremy's book really focuses on, is that you're looking at watersheds. So the water, Mississippi River watershed connects all these states, and it goes from the east coast of the Rockies to the west coast of the Appalachians. It's the Missouri River, the Ohio River, all of the rivers that feed down and end up in the so-called dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. So the ocean begins at the mountaintop, and it descends all the way to the abyssal plain. And everything that we do, that we put in our drains or we put in our fields or we put in our sewers, we put in our storm drains, in the end, all ends up in the ocean.
The ocean is the toilet bowl of humanity.
And that, too, is interconnected because whatever we put in ends up mixed with whatever else people put in. And we've always thought that the ocean was infinite and it could heal any damage whatsoever. But that is now proven fact. It is not true. So where we have despoiled the land, we have exhausted the land. We are about to do the same thing with the ocean, and that is the key to our survival. And if you actually look at the other side of that coin and you see the power and the importance of water, the freshwater ocean continuum, for the survival of human life, it's the one element, natural element that everybody needs in exactly the same amounts, whether you're a family or an individual or a nation state, you cannot live 3, 4, 5, 6 days without water. And so there is this constant despoilation of the water from every input, and it all ends up in this kind of planetary output. And if we allow, if we exhaust that too, we have a real crisis.
Because these problems with drinking water are well documented, and as far as I know, nobody's claiming they're not happening, and because the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is something that could be measured, is there any movement to change these farming practices that contribute to this?
I would say not only measured, but predicted. So this heroic woman, Nancy Rabelais, predicts every year the size of the dead zone, and she gets it within a few percent based on the nitrogen concentration in Mississippi River water, which is a function of that.
So is there any movement to change?
There's huge pressure. You know, for 20 years, we've been doing the research to farm differently. We know how to do it, but it's the evil empire. You have Monsanto, you have, you know, Roundup, 20 Olympic swimming pools of this herbicide toxin that are dumped on these fields because the GMO corn can't survive unless the weeds are all killed, blah, blah, blah. It goes down the line. This is a matter of resistance. It's no different than the fossil fuel industry. Everybody knows the harms. It's no different from the smoking scandal. How long did it take us to get it established that smoking causes cancer without the fight? And so we know what to do. We know it's harmful. We talked to that lovely farmer, John Weber, who said, yes, we know about that. We have to fix it. But of course, they're not fixing it because they're stuck in a mode of farming. Most of them are up to their eyeballs in debt. You know, the equipment on John Weber's farm was worth $5 or $6 million of tractors and combines and whatever, and they don't know how to change. And so we're just business as usual, when we know exactly what needs to be done. And the EPA has just stepped out of the picture. So those toxins in Lake Erie, they have no directives. They have no power. They exert no effort to actually stop the source of the problem.
But think about this. We point to the fossil fuel industry, right? Fertilizer is a fossil fuel. Plastic is a product of fossil fuels. Emissions in the air are an outcome of fossil fuel consumption. There is this multi-headed hydra of effects that over time exceeded their value. We all have benefited from the fossil fuel industry in the terms of our growth since the Industrial Revolution. But suddenly the consequences outweigh the values. And we are stuck in a cycle where the power of the fossil fuel industry is essentially determining the extension of all of these particular phenomena that are real, with real measurable damages and real human impact.
But, you know, I want to jump in and say I'm actually optimistic, believe it or not, because what we're seeing also is that business people are seeing what Peter just said. And so you're seeing this extraordinary amount of money being poured into renewable energy in spite of the current political administration. And so, and the electricity that comes from wind and solar is cheaper than new fossil fuel plants, and people are making a lot of money building them.
But let me ask you this, Jeremy. Yes, renewable energy is growing, but your book is called Breakpoint. Is it too late?
It's too late for a lot, but it's not too late for being not as bad as it could be. And that's what we have to recognize. You know, I'm actually a permanent resident of Maine, but I'm a dyed-in-the-wool New Yorker. And so I'm in New York a lot for the theater and whatever. I love New York. New York has 50 or 100 years, and then that's going to be the end of New York.
No matter what we do.
No matter what we do. Now, well, actually, they'll move to the Bronx and to higher ground and whatever, but a lot of it will be gone. You know, a lot of iconic New York will be gone. The good news is a place like New York gets it. And so they're sort of, it's in the pathway of thinking that nothing is forever. The tragedy is places like Florida that are in utter denial and encouraging even more and more movement to an area where people are essentially doomed. Okay. I mean, it'll be underwater very soon.
We're going to take a quick break. So much to talk about. We've got Jeremy Jackson and Peter Neal, both esteemed oceanographers. Jeremy's new book is called Breakpoint, Reckoning with America's Environmental Crises. We'll be right back.
You make Maine calling possible, as do the Lincoln Home in Newcastle, offering independent assisted living and unique memory loss care in a home-like environment. Lincoln-home.org. New England Cancer Specialists, 50 years of working toward better outcomes for Maine patients. Learn more at newenglandcancerspecialists.org. And Rosemont Wellness Center, featuring independent health practitioners such as Six Branches Family Acupuncture, in Portland and at rosemontwellness.com.
If you want to know what people are really thinking, don't look at their Facebook posts. Look at what they're searching for on Google.
Google gives you an incentive to tell the truth, to get the information you need. So you kind of have to tell Google what you're thinking if you want the results.
A data scientist looks at Google searches to see what they reveal about us. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. If you've been away from Maine and you're a classical music fan, you may be pleased to note that our Maine Public Classical over-the-air FM network has expanded. We have stations in Portland, Bangor, and Waterville, also in western Maine and the Bridgeton-Fryeburg area, down east, including the Bar Harbor region, and our latest signal serves much of the coast from about Rockland to Freeport out of the Booth Bay-Brunswick region. 24/7 classical music. How to find Maine Public Classical is at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, facing the interconnected environmental threats around us. Joining me today, Peter Neal, who's director of the World Ocean Observatory, and Jeremy Jackson, emeritus professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and co-author of the new book, Breakpoint. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to calls, though, I want to talk about sea level rise, important part of your book, Jeremy, and in just a very important part of the discussions that this country and the rest of the world is having right now. And I know that there's wild variability in the predictions about what we're going to see in the next 10, 50, 100 years. I'll start with you, Peter. What prediction do you believe is the most accurate for what we're going to see in terms of sea level rise?
That it's going to rise.
But how much?
Well, that's the problem, or that's the understanding. It will be different in every place because there are many other factors than rise. But the basic rise factor will be there. Volumetrically, there's another issue that should be in the same discussion, which is the changing pH of the ocean, the acidification of the ocean, which has very similar kinds of consequence. So you have the question of adapting or mitigating or inventing another way of responding to what is predictable sea level rise in your area. There are modeling projection tools that town managers can look and actually relocate culverts, bridges, all of the kinds of things that you could actually do to respond. But it's not the same. There's not one solution that is going to save everyone.
Minimum global average 3 feet by 2100, but that doesn't include these little inconveniences called Antarctica and Greenland, because it's very hard to measure and predict. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which has been accused by the right wing of being extremist, is actually hyper-conservative, dangerously conservative. And their number is somewhere between a third of a meter and a meter by 2100, so roughly a maximum of 3 feet. But most of us believe that the number is almost certainly more like 5 or 6 feet. And the critical thing is that it's certainly going to be a foot in the next 25 years. And so...
a foot in the lifetime of most of the people listening to this program.
That depends on the age. In terms of my daughter, I mean, she's going to see 3 to 5 feet. And what that means, Maine gets off the hook pretty much, except for the low parts of Portland here. But, you know, what that means is Florida is underwater. What that means is that the coastline of Louisiana will be at Baton Rouge, 100 miles north of New Orleans. Savannah will be underwater. Charleston will be underwater. Much of the North Carolina coast will be underwater. I've given a lot of talks at the Naval War College. Virtually every naval base of the U.S. Navy is going to have to be relocated because it's going to be underwater, including the big one in Virginia at Norfolk, which is going to cost billions of dollars to replace. So these are real things. And what you have to remember is it's not the sea level alone. It's the sea level and the storms
and the
storm surge. I mean, Hurricane Sandy was not the strongest wind in the world, but that water got forced into Long Island Sound and the Inner Harbor, and it drowned Lower Manhattan. And so, and every half inch of sea level rise exponentially increases the risk to cities because of the storm surge and that extra penetration. And so, it's a really, really, really big deal. And the country, the entire Gulf Coast and the entire East Coast of the United States is vulnerable. And what's tragic is you have the communities that get it, are struggling with it, and thinking about how are we going to adapt, how are we going to mitigate, and how are we going to get out of Dodge. And then you have the places that for financial gain are just denying everything and leaving people in harm's way.
The water that comes in also comes out. And if you look at Sandy, for example, you realize how much damage was the incoming and how much damage was the outgoing. People tend to forget about that. What I think is imperative is that we understand this is happening now, and that every responsible manager in any level of our lives, whether it's city management or corporate management or even community management, that we begin to think about this and how to reorganize ourselves in advance. When you look at the cost of the damage of Sandy alone, it represents billions of dollars. Look at Puerto Rico.
$65 billion for Sandy.
The taxpayer is going to pay for, because the government is not willing to understand that there is a problem that needs to be planned for. That's the role of government. The role of government is to anticipate things that the rest of us cannot necessarily do immediately, and then also provide us with the tools and the opportunity to fix it. I have enormous faith that we can fix it, but we have to be able to understand the problem first, and we have to be able to explore the alternatives. And if we're constantly having the problems and the alternatives denied and underfinanced and ridiculed, then we are essentially acting irresponsibly as government, and we will pay the price. People are already paying the price in Puerto Rico and Florida and still in New York, Flint, all of these places that are all part of the same problem that have not been addressed or redressed or thought about in terms of how we're going to respond in the future.
We'll go to Gabriel calling from Dover, New Hampshire. Hi, Gabriel. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I love your show. I'm just really wanting to call in and sort of express how much everybody seems to try and be doing something on their own, but it seems like there's a general lack of sort of communication or everybody caring. And I feel like the lack of moral outrage and how low environment seems to rank in our political discourse is just really hurting. And I don't know if that's the fossil fuel industry influencing the media companies and not allowing us to talk about it more, or what. But I just wanted to hear your thoughts on why, I mean, if it's a risk of our civilization and our whole humanity, why this isn't more important.
So I'm going to jump in there and say that actually in a lot of places there is a lot of outrage and there is a lot of constructive response. And then, of course, there are places where that's not happening. So, for example, in Rhode Island, they have mapped the entire coast and put online for any citizen of Rhode Island to see the vulnerability of literally every street corner along the entire coast with relation to sea level rise. And they're doing this as a public service. And so you see things like that. And I used to live in San Diego when I worked at Scripps, and the entire city of San Diego has committed to carbon neutrality within 25 years, and they're well on their way to achieving it. So I guess what I see is a lack of federal leadership, but I see a great deal of variability in sort of mid-scale, local to regional leadership. And this is a good thing in the places where it's happening, but it's a tragic thing in that it's tearing us as a country apart even more. So the blue states basically are responding and the red states aren't. And it doesn't take a genius to realize what the downstream political response consequences that are going to be.
Europe, of course, is way ahead of us in all of these places. There's a response in terms of planning. There are organizations now that are literally planning for international watershed, looking at and analyzing the situation, looking at the projections, the tools for projection, understanding where things need to be located or relocated in the future. So there are tools available. Even in Maine, we have University of Maine Climate Change Institute has something called Climate Reanalyzer. You can go on web. You can look at where you live. You can see what the models project in terms of climate, of sea level rise in your area. A local town manager can use that to plan in terms of roads or bridges specifications. So there are tools available. What's lacking here is not so much knowledge or technology or even capital. There's plenty of capital even. What's lacking is political will.
And leadership.
And leadership. And what they're a function of one or the other. If we have enough political will, the leaders will either be replaced or they will change their policies. But if we don't have any political will, and the only way we're going to do that is massive education and communications.
Or as the caller said, outrage. I mean, yeah. I'm a veteran of the civil rights era and all of that. And we were outraged and I think we made a difference. And certainly we did about the war that followed and all the rest of it.
But wait a minute.
I feel very strongly that that good stuff is starting to happen. And I think it's the reason I harp on that is because it's really easy to be Dr. Doom and Gloom. That's what I used to be called when I worked on ocean fisheries issues. And people just give up. And so when there are real examples of positive change, I think it's vitally important to emphasize those. And so I have a laundry list of those positive cases as my antidote to the systemic doom and gloom.
Well, yes. How could I say no to that? I mean, of course, am I Dr. Doom and Gloom? No. I think I am a realist, however. And
yeah,
I do believe that every small action we take, plastic bags in the markets and plastics in toothpaste and all these things that have impact on the ocean, we can all make that kind of difference. But we have to collectivize it to a point where it actually will make a difference in terms of the volumetric and the extent of the thing. And the way to do that is through much more radical, almost revolutionary action. So yes, we can vote. That's one thing we can do. Secondly, we can act locally and regionally. We can do that. We can do it in the state legislature. But the forces against pervade in many of those places. My feeling is that all great change in the world is not evolutionary. It's mostly revolutionary. We're going to need a radical change of paradigm of how we structure ourselves, what we value, how we structure ourselves, and how we behave. We're acting using the 19th century paradigm built in the Industrial Revolution, based on fossil fuels, driven by consumption. We now know that that no longer works. So what's next? And I believe there is a solution on the other side, but it's going to require a people to understand that it is in their absolute, vital, immediate interest to accept those changes and resist the vested interest, learn about the problem, resist the vested interest, and stop being afraid of change. Maine is notorious for its fear of change. Wind power in Maine was destroyed by fear of change. We are now doing it with aquaculture in Maine because we're afraid of change. There are all sorts of problems associated with it, but we're very good at solving specific problems.
Yeah, people are afraid of change everywhere, but people are also afraid of drowning. So even in hyper-conservative South Florida, not that far from Mar-a-Lago, the people have the water lapping up on their lawns every month, high tide, and they're really changing. I'm a very left-wing person. If it's not obvious, I'll just say it. But one of the most hopeful things that I've seen is that a bunch of very non-left-wing people, Michael Bloomberg and James Baker, former Secretary of State for both Bushes and blah, 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 got together at Yale about 4 months ago, 5 months ago, and actually talked about it, saying, well, you know, we can actually fix this. We can go completely to renewable energy for $350 billion a year over 50 years, and we already spend that kind of money, and why don't we just do it? The Xcel Energy Company put out some bids for solar and wind-powered power plants just, you know, to greenwash, and the bids came back so good that they are now projecting to produce half of their electricity for 10 states in the Midwest from renewable sources of energy. So I think it's actually changing fast. I think where I definitely agree with Peter is that there's going to have to be a sociological tipping point in which people get so angry and so mad that they respond.
Gabriel, thanks so much for your call. We're going to take another break. When we come back, more of your calls and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Central Maine Healthcare's Topsom Care Center, bringing specialty care, imaging, lab services, and more to one convenient location at the Topsom Fair Mall. Portland attorney William McHugh, representing clients in planning, administering, and problem-solving estates and trusts since 1996. And Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com.
Mainers are struggling to pay the rent, and they're being evicted from neighborhoods across the state. Last year, more than 5,700 eviction cases were filed with the courts. For some, eviction leads to homelessness. For others, it means doubling up with friends and relatives, continually uprooting children, missing school, and missing work.
Told myself it was the last time it was going to happen, and I just feel bad for letting down my kids and all that.
I'm on a fixed income, I'm retired, and there isn't one $500 apartment. They're all $750, $850. It's insane.
What's being done to address this crisis? I'm Susan Sharon. Join us for a week-long special series, Eviction, Life Unpacked, on Morning Edition, Maine Things Considered, and online, beginning Monday, August 6th.
And coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, we'll have World Affairs, a panel discussion on the issues of trade and tariffs with Europe, China, and others. That's World Affairs in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are talking about environmental crises and solutions. Joining me, Jeremy Jackson with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and co-author of the new book, Breakpoint, Reckoning with America's Environmental Crises. And also with me, Peter Neal. He is the director of the World Ocean Observatory. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. And we will go to a call. We'll go to Susan, who's calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I like this discussion. I really think that developing political will and leadership is important. And I want to talk about two concrete solutions, ways people in Maine can get involved in doing that. One is through the organization called the Citizens Climate Lobby, and the website is citizensclimatelobby.org. There are 7 chapters of the Citizens Climate Lobby in Maine, and it's a national organization. There are tens of thousands of members, and we get training through the organization of how to work with our political leaders in Congress and in the state level, especially on the issue of putting a price on carbon. But it's a great resource. It's very friendly to new people, and it's very practical. And I should say it's bipartisan. There are Republicans, Independents, and Democrats. And then the other one is called the Climate Solutions Caucus, which is 86 members of the House of Representatives, 43 Republicans and 43 Democrats, who have come together to work on these issues. And the number of people in that caucus is going up all the time, and their impact, they're starting to make an actual impact. So I think I really agree with the fear and the sense of realism of what a big problem this is that the speakers are advocating. But I think it's really encouraging to hear about these political developments.
Susan, thank you so much for your call. And Jeremy, I know this was important for you to talk about, is what communities can do, what individuals can do not change what's happening, but slow it down.
Well, actually, or really change. So to my great surprise, the city of San Diego, which had a fairly strongly conservative history, is a model for it's the 8th largest city in the United States. It's committed itself to achieving carbon neutrality in about 30 years in terms of its energy sector. And it has embarked upon a legally binding set of guidelines, which they're actually working on to do what the last caller referred to in the abstract to actually achieve for the city of San Diego. Everything from planting millions of trees to ameliorate the climate to having all city vehicles be electric within a time frame. And it was done by the Republican mayor and the Democratic City Council. And it was done by people who loved the city of San Diego, could see what was happening to San Diego, and so they acted. And so, and California in general is a hotbed of this kind of local and regional action, which is incredibly hopeful. But the politics were right there. So what the last caller was talking about is incredibly important for trying to change those politics. And here in Maine, we have a very divided situation where we have people who understand the reality of the environmental situation and the ones who choose not to understand, although I feel it's impossible to believe that they really don't understand.
Susan, thanks so much for your call. We have an email from Chop. Does any individual action against global warming help at this point? Should I silently rage against the Maine people who leave their SUVs running while they go into the grocery store so that when we come out, the vehicle is still cool? Or should I just let that go? We can only invent our way out of this at this point. You've talked about invention a couple times. What do you mean by that exactly, Peter? And how do you respond to Chop?
Well, first, you change your own behavior, which this gentleman may have done already. That's great. You persuade others. You demonstrate others. You advocate in unexpected places. For example, in churches, in civic associations. All of these organizations consume. They consume plastic. They consume water. They contribute to the problem in many different ways. And if we reinvent ourselves from within in all of these institutions, then collectively we will actually address the problem. We also inadvertently or advertently are building a constituency for the alternative. And the alternative then cannot be understood in terms of personal advantage and disadvantage and community advantage and disadvantage, and actually state and regional advantage and disadvantage. So there is in all of these solutions a new way forward for Maine or the nation that will build jobs, that will create value, and continue our quality of life in a way that's sustainable. So much of this is so limited and self-centered to the present moment. I'll leave my car running. I don't really care by that action what the impact is on my child or my children's children. And that is what we're talking about here.
I want to know what you're talking about when you say invention. Are you talking about somebody at MIT or Caltech inventing something to spew into the ozone? Or are you talking about something else?
No, I'm talking about collective energy. I'm talking about ideas and behaviors and structures and values. For example, if we don't, let's talk about upstream, downstream. There is an enormous continuity. It's all through Jeremy's book. The continuity of what happens upstream descends and has consequence downstream. That's a regional watershed planning opportunity. But we're organized not to do that. So we could reinvent how we govern within a watershed context that would exactly prohibit somebody doing something upstream that destroys the shellfish beds down below.
And I want to get back to this business of the way you asked it in the beginning, all the little actions. They're incredibly important educational experiences. I mean, I'm an environmentalist. I've been one all my life. But as I've clamped down on my own behavior, I've seen case after case where I was thoughtlessly doing things that were wasteful or stupid or unsustainable. And so I think that I'm a big believer in the importance of this local engagement, change in behavior, saying, hey, dude, why are you running a car or all the rest of it? Don't you realize you're polluting my environment or whatever? Because in doing that, we prepare ourselves for more radical change in the future as we come to grips with the really big problems. I think, and you know, the plastic bag issue, look at the way it's debated here and in many other communities. It's a very serious issue. And I'm a marine biologist. I can tell you the ocean is a junkyard of plastic.
Though I will say that the plastic, and we did a program this week, somebody in Portland, Maine, who throws their plastic bag in the trash, that plastic bag is not ending up in the ocean. That's being incinerated out at Eco Maine.
That's right. That's right. But you know, all the boats and all the whatever, and the amount of plastic that comes out of Maine, I can assure you, is huge. And single-use plastic bags are an incredible problem. And, you know, in Switzerland 25 years ago, they said, fine, we'll give you one for $2. And all of a sudden, everybody started carrying their bag to the supermarket every day. The fact that we burn it for energy has minimized the problem in some contexts, but
although it creates particulates that go up into the atmosphere,
right.
They descend into the ocean, they become part of the water column.
Yeah.
The value equation is this. If you took every piece of plastic that exists on Earth today and recycled it, which we have the technology to do, there's a capital, there's a profit motive in it. It's never been advanced because fossil fuel companies don't want it to happen. But if you took every piece of plastic and recycled it, you would never have to make another piece of plastic again. Now, you can also do away with it. People keep saying, oh, we're going to recycle or we're going to do this. The best thing to do is to boycott the use of plastic at the source. This is the same thing, the same argument I would make for every other thing that we're talking about. If something is polluting our environment, we can mitigate it or adapt to it downstream. But why don't we address the problem at the source of the problem? Yeah. No more of plastic to go into the ocean at all.
And why are you incinerating your garbage? The reason you're doing it is the Chinese economy has gotten so good they decided that they didn't want our garbage
right.
anymore.
Right.
And we are so unprepared for that because we don't have the deep philosophical commitment right. to the notion that generating garbage is something we should be minimizing.
We're going to go to Charles, who's calling from Bass Harbor. Hi, Charles. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to point out that there seems to be a little bit of hypocrisy in this conversation. There's a lot of talk about little actions and boycotting at the source and making sacrifices. And yet the author at the opening, his opening comment was that he took this romantic drive down through the South and drove from farm to farm and talked to everybody and had such a great time. I imagine it was thousands of miles, perhaps.
No, actually, I went with public transportation as much as I could. I stayed in limited places.
Okay. And traveling from Maine to New York to watch a play, these are the kinds of sacrifices nobody wants to make.
That's right. And I don't drive to New York to watch a play. I minimize my trips by going back and forth for times. All of us do this. I also am in the process of buying an electric car, which will...
Electric car is not a non-polluting, unless you hook it up to PV panels.
Well, I mean, isn't the bottom line that being a human on planet Earth is not usually very good for the environment, but we can all minimize our impact?
Yeah, I would say that I very self-consciously minimize the amount of emissions that I create and all the rest. We were talking, driving down here to be here for the station, that I've owned a car for 20 years that has a grand total of 69,500 miles on it. In 20 years, because I don't drive uselessly. I go into town once a week to do my shopping rather than every day. And I work from home. And when I was at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in La Jolla, California, I deliberately chose a house that was more expensive for less land so that I could walk to work rather than being driving a car. I made choices every day in my life there that would be in accord with what I believe. Of course, I was still producing energy. And when I get invited to give a talk someplace where they really want to hear me, I ask them to pay the carbon credits. I think that's sort of silly, but I do. I mean, we all, by living and breathing, we pollute. The point is we can minimize the amount of pollution we do.
Charles, thanks for bringing up that point. We're going to move, let's see, to Bob in Bangor. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been upset and angry and depressed about this whole situation for 30 years, ever since James Hansen appeared before Congress. And all along, I've been wondering, where's everybody else's upset? and that is germane to my point. I don't want to talk about anything technical. They've covered that pretty well, but I'd like to make the commentary, the statement, that I think people's attitude in general is wrong. I think we should all be, frankly, depressed as hell about what is going on. This is our planet we're talking about here, and we don't seem to want to talk about it. And some of us, of course, are still in denial, and which is even worse, but most of us aren't. They're right. It was around 2006, after Gore's film came out, that people's consciousness really began to change as a whole. But that was 12 years ago, and things have happened since then, of course. The person we have in the White House and all of his fans, supposedly 40% of the country, are still very much in denial. Like I say, I think that people have to accept the reality, come face to face with the acknowledgement that we're the cause of it, and that's going to require an adaptation itself. But what is really needed is a grieving period. That's where the depression comes in.
Well,
okay, Bob. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I would just say that how about a little anger instead of being depressed? We've seen the great social movements in this country motivated by anger and courage that achieved great, great change. And a little bit of anger and courage and political will could help to move us in the right direction. And I believe we're on the precipice of doing that.
Peter?
Well, denial is an interesting thing. What if the deniers are wrong? That's the thing to think about. We have all this evidence of what happens that's out there, and yet we're going to deny it. Okay, deny it. But what happens if you're wrong? If you're wrong and you deny, the consequences will be exponentially more damaging than they are now. And by the way, the people who deny the most may well be the people who suffer the most. That paradox is beyond me. I really don't understand why people can't see beyond themselves, see even in the context of their community or their own family, to understand that this has something to do with continuity. Your genealogy is at risk. Your community is at risk. And that's serious challenging that requires a serious response. Denial is a simple, simplistic response. And the information is there for you to make a whole series of individual choices. And some of them may go this way, and some of us will go that way. Some of us would be more successful. Some of us may not be successful at all. But unless we try and do this, the consequences are enormous. And I feel as if we have to adapt a new way of living, which I argue is organized around the value of the most precious commodity on earth, which is water, to live.
Thank you both for being here. The voice you just heard, Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. Also here, Jeremy Jackson, emeritus professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. His new book is Breakpoint, Reckoning with America's Environmental Crises. Nikki Shields ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as links and resources at mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Evictions in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.